Chapter 3, Naples. We are moving again, this time to Naples. It is the second-story bedroom I love the most. It is the biggest room in the house, the room that we four children all share. It faces the wide colonnade street, the street that used to be a canal. Now it's the widest street in Naples, with stately colonial houses promenading on either side. The street arches wide into a horseshoe. There's a grass park at the end next to the canal where we play baseball and hope that we don't hit the ball under the glass windows of the houses on either side. And at the end of the grass, there's a sidewalk that lines the canals that meander around thoughtfully in between the mainland and the two little islands that developers built in the late 1800s as a way to attract new homeowners into this picturesque, just like Europe, lifestyle. Our house is towards the other end of the street, closer to the main road, but from my window, I can see all the way down to the canal and to the opening in the canal that leads to the bay, and beyond the bay, I can imagine the beach on the other side. I can run up the stone stairs, two at a time, to my bedroom to check on my forever wandering younger brother, to see in a flash if he has meandered on down to the canal with its still silent waters lapping quietly against the barnacled cement walls that will cover quickly over him if he falls into the water. If he has wandered down there, I can race back down the stairs and run for all I'm worth to head him off before he gets that far and bring him back to the house. Or I can lie in my bed under the open window with the salty ocean breeze blowing on the curtains, a reminder of what I can't see that lays just beyond the bay, the ocean. This is my new lullaby, the palm tree that rises up between our house and the neighbors, the fronds softly slapping against the side of the house, the soft cooing of the pigeons that are nesting free. There's the piano at the end of the hallway at the top of the wide stone stairs and my sister's cello. I am taking guitar lessons now, something that my mother signed my brother up for, but he didn't want to go. I can run down to Gilmore Music in Naples, meet the music teacher all on my own. My mother's working in the day. Later on in high school, I'll rush home from school, carefully put on eyeliner and nylons, and walk slowly to the liquor store on the main street to buy cigarettes at 27 cents a pack and then smoke them in the tiny backyard that we have. Practically passing out. They really are too much for me. I can't help but thinking about all of the beauty around us, all the coiffed lawns with manicured plants, the quiet canal water, the stillness and the unchanging houses look stiff and formal whenever I walk by. My mother's friends who are wealthy and who give us their daughters' hand-me-downs. We spend all summer taking in their clothes and hemming them and starching them and getting them ready for September when we start back to school. I walk up and down the streets on long solitary walks when I am older, and I'm allowed to wander through the neighborhoods, and I just can't help thinking that we are leading someone else's life here in this little community. Someone else's life that is on display on this big white street that never blinks, but keeps an always open eye. I miss the battered old boardwalk, the raging sea, the wind that blows any way that it chooses, the sea salt that dries and crusts on your skin until it stretches taut and hot in the sun. I miss the women who wear sun-beaten old bathing suits and laugh their husky smokers' laughs, and who don't give a damn about anything besides having fun. Where I can feel and see and know that things change, are changing, and are being changed by forces greater and more powerful than me. And that all of it, the ebb and the flow of the tides, the quiet times and the rages of the sea, the mornings and the evenings, the late afternoons, that all of these differences I am part of, and that they are part of me. My sister and I go to the peninsula whenever we can. Before she's old enough to drive, we get life jackets for the boys and floats. We put the life jackets on them and put them on the top of the floats and swim the mile across the bay. We cross over from the bay and then walk across Ocean Boulevard to the ocean side of the peninsula. We bring money to buy little lunch things at the local store. We spend all day at the beach with the boys and then we swim home again in the late afternoon, dodging the sailboats on our way back, climbing up the dock, going to the back door to the shower so we won't track sand in all over the house, and feeling that wonderful, fulfilled, sunburnt, satisfied sense of the day. These are our summer times, back to the ocean, our home. When my sister gets older and can drive, we take the convertible and go with our friends down the Pacific Coast Highway, to Laguna Beach, to the Crescent Bay Cove to body surf in the waves. The water there is crystal clear, the sand is a pristine white. The waves are huge and full, and they come crashing down on the shore with a fierceness that I love. The coves are full of hermit crabs and sea anemones and octopus, starfish, and clams. I can spend hours scampering over the rocks, timing the waves that crash against them and filling up the tide pools, and then scamper back again. It's the ocean, full of life and things to explore, that I love. My brother John is 6. He is incorrigible. He has a sideways grin and a shock of hair to match. Long, lanky limbs, sunburned skin, clear, clean, cornflower blue eyes that come from Scandinavian stock thousands of years back. Eyes that look out to the horizons that stretch out to oceans of corn and grain, that stretch out across the Atlantic Ocean and to the end of the continent, that end up in California. That kind of blue eyes. Firstborn son of Jerome Leadholm Peterson, firstborn after 2 girls. My father's coming home from work. He's tired, the kind of tired that never goes away, but he's happy to see us. He's wearing his suit and tie. He has his black briefcase and his black shoes. My mom greets him at the door. Okay, look at what John did. I was in the house cleaning and John was outside playing and I found all of these on the front porch. She has a handful of gas caps in her hand. There's a whole bag of them on the floor. I've gone to some of the cars, but I can't figure out which car they go to. John has done something that no one could ever think of doing. He has taken off all of the gas caps off of all the cars on the colonnade. By my calculation, I'm trying to figure out this out while my mother is talking. It's at least 30 cars. My father sighs. He glances at John, who is looking from one parent's face to the other, calculating where the anger is going to be the worst. This is his daily task. It's almost always my mother. She's much more explosive than my dad. Come on, Bubber, my dad's nickname for John. Let's go. My dad shuffles out the front door, my brother trailing behind. We're all kind of embarrassed. We're all hoping no one on the street will notice they don't have a gas cap on their car. That they don't step outside and see my dad and my brother huddled over their car, pawing through the paper bag, trying on the different gas caps to see which one will fit. I sit on the front porch and watch. Besides the upstairs bedroom window, that's our little perch. A lot goes on that front porch. It takes them a long time. It's nightfall when they finish. The dinner is waiting for them on the teakwood table. I'm kind of nervous. What happens if they made a mistake and gave the person the wrong gas cap? Who's going to find out? Will some neighbor come pounding on our door to complain about what John did? There's always the possibility. Huddled between all of the squashed down houses on the peninsula, sandwiched between the sea and the sand and the rows of houses, we weren't very visible. But here in the colonnade, we're front and center, as my dad likes to say. There's nothing that escapes the eye. My mother buys a convertible as a second-hand car for the family. It stays with us the whole time on the colonnade, although by the looks of the street, it doesn't really fit in. It's old. The black canvas top is faded. It's a faded yellow, and it has smooth, tired wheels. It's our beach car, our car for around-the-town errands and taking kids and friends everywhere. When my dad comes home from work, the kids on the block, my brother's friends, all run outside. He will give them a spin in the convertible, and they scramble in, pushing and shoving for the front seat, where my brother, privileged, perches. My dad laughs. Okay, everybody, ready to go. He revs up the motor, looking behind his back to make sure everyone is in, and then off they go. They don't go far. At the end of the block is the Naples Hotel, which is where the gondolas used to be launched from. Now, the street, the Toledo, and the roundabout in the middle is a small park with tall palm trees. My dad heads around the roundabout, down Toledo Lane, up and down and over the street, and back around the roundabout one more time. The kids scream and shout. They love this. It takes 10 minutes, maybe, but to them, it is the time of their lives. My brother John and his friend Allison from across the street decide one day, when the hood is up, to sit on the top. The faded, sun-bleached canvas doesn't hold them, and they plunge right through to the seat. No one is hurt, but my mom doesn't have the money to fix the hood, so it just stays down all year, rain or shine. My mother decides, shortly after the broken hood debacle, to paint the car black. Maybe she is feeling sorry for the canvas hood that she doesn't have the money to fix. I'm not sure. She also has itchy fingers for painting. My mother loves to paint. She paints everything, pictures, furniture. She uses cans of spray paint, which is, I'm sure, all she can afford. She's an incredible painter for all other things, but in this venture she fails. Our poor little convertible is a sad, drippy black now. The drips have congealed on the body, and there they will stay. The stories with this car just never stop. My mom is driving on the peninsula where we used to live. She is driving the convertible and she has on her bathing suit. She is doing her daily ritual, which is going with her friends to swim out to the buoy and back again. A policeman stops her for speeding. May I see your driver's license, please? There's a lot of Irish in my mom. It comes out at the appropriate times, depending upon your point of view. You were speeding, miss. I caught you going 10 miles over the speed limit. My mother's furious. She still cuts a good figure in the bathing suit. She thinks he stopped her because that's all she has on. Well, officer, she tells him as she gets out of the car, if you want my driver's license, you're going to have to catch me to get it. His jaw drops. She walks across the street, crosses over to the bay, and jumps into the water. My mother is an excellent swimmer. All she has to do is swim across the bay to the canal. It's less than a mile. Climb up on the dock, and from there, walk down the street to her house. Then she can call all of her girlfriends on the telephone and giggle and brag about what an atrocious and funny thing she has done. Someone will pick her up and take her to get her car. And that's just what she does. In its later years, our little convertible decides to protest all of its mistreatment. For some mysterious, unknown reason, the horn starts to go off at 4 in the morning, at least 3 or 4 times a week. Because our bedroom faces the street, we are the first to hear it go off. It becomes like a second alarm clock. I wake up, put on my bathrobe, and knock on my parents' door. Dad, Dad, I whisper, it's the car, it's the horn again. The bed groans as my dad gets up, and he comes out in his plaid flannel bathrobe, wrapping the belt around his waist, going to the kitchen to look for the screwdriver. He paws through the kitchen drawers until he finds it. He quietly opens the door, and shuffling in his slippers, screwdriver and flashlight in hand, he heads on out to the protesting car. I'm never quite sure what he does. He tinkers and pokes with the screwdriver. He pushes and pulls, and then finally we are relieved. The horn has stopped. It's a one-time magic, though. Tomorrow morning at 4 a.m. it will go off again. Finally, by the time I am a sophomore in high school and the kids in town are using our little convertible for joyrides, maybe the kids who are stealing it are the same kids that my dad took on rides when they were little. We wake up in the morning and it's gone. We find it in another alleyway down the street from the house. This begins to happen on a regular basis. We are always looking for our lost car the way you look for a lost dog. I jump into the red Triumph that my mother has bought me for $500 so that I can pick up the boys and bring them home from school. I go through the alleyways this way and that, seeing where it's been left. It's never very far away, and we always, always find it.